Hello, it's Security Weekly News, episode 213. Welcome to the week of 15 May 2022. Elon balks CISA, Nebuchadnezzar, Liangia, iPhone hacks, data leaks, the EU, Chinese fraud reports, all that, and Jason Wood on this episode of Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Cybercriminals are working overtime. Last year in the fourth quarter alone, phishing attacks disguised as COVID testing information increased by 521%. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cybercriminals use them to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Find out about the 13 email threat types and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. Get your free ebook at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more.
All right, I'm Doug White, and this is Security Weekly News. CISA, that is the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, issued a complicated, a complicated warning. When I first started reading, I got really confused. Apparently, an Active Directory authentication issue, that is CVE-2022-26925, which is something to do with the Petty Potum stuff that was from like last year, maybe it was even the year before. But this is a Windows NTLM relay attack vector. So this is an old problem. And it was patched finally in May of 2022. So, and in that patch, they updated that and 74 other flaws in Windows. So that's good news, right? I mean, so stuff, old stuff, some recent stuff and so forth, all getting patched. But the bad news is that as a part of these patches, there were two vulnerabilities, Windows Kerberos and Active Directory Domain Services that will then... Those patches caused a new service authentication problem when you push them out to your Windows Server domain controllers. Okay, so far I was sort of following along. But here's the catch. They had to take the issue off of their list of known active problems in the wild because all federal civilian executive branch agencies are required to implement these patches by June 1st due to current rules. So anything on that list. So CISA had to take them off the list of active vulnerabilities because if they had them on there, then the people would actually have to use the patch, which would create a whole new problem. So they did say that just for your references, the patches will not cause any issues on client devices and non-domain controllers, and they should be installed, which makes sense. But the issue only affects the domain controllers, and there is a workaround available, and there are instructions in the article. So basically, you know, if you have these, you should probably check. If you have domain controllers, you should probably check this up. So, and if they've been patched already, well, you may want to read this anyway. But basically, if they keep the vulnerabilities on the active list and they have to install the patch, even though that patch is going to cause worse things and break the domain controller, so they had to remove the vulnerabilities from the list, even though they're a threat, in order to prevent other requirements from requiring you to implement requirements on the bad patches on your system, which would then break the systems and then create new vulnerabilities, which would have to be put on the list. And then I don't know exactly what happens then, but I think Joe Biden, you know, drags you in an alley with a ball bat or something. But anyway, you gotta love government. Dr. Docs, paging Dr. Docs. Well, the U.S. Department of Justice doxed someone. They charged them, which is the same thing as doxing them. But this person's name is Moises Luis Zagala Gonzalez, and who keeps being referred to as Zagala or Zagala. I don't know how you say that. Zagala. They put that in parentheses. I don't know why. But Dr. Gonzalez, I'm just going to call him that, is a 55-year-old cardiologist with French and Venezuelan citizenship who lives in Ciudad Bolivar, Venezuela. Okay, all that already starts to sound like the beginning of a James Bond movie. Get a da-da-da-da. You know, I probably just violated 45 copyrights right there, but I was off key, so don't worry about it. It'll never stand up in court because they'll make them listen to that 50 times. But anyway, Dr. Gonzalez was apparently the creator of Jigsaw and Thanos ransomwares. So he was apparently also renting Thanos to people to use. There's more even. So the good doctor, who also goes by the handles Nosophorus, which I didn't actually know this one, but it means disease bringer in Greek, or bringer of disease. That's a pretty good one. I'm going to name a server that. Asclepius, which was a doctor in Greek history, who was the basis for, who was actually based on a Egyptian story, and later was the basis for a lot of biblical stories. But we won't get into that because it gets people upset. But and then he also went by Nebuchadnezzar, who was a Babylonian king, who was, well, basically an ancient anti-Semite, who, you know, sort of a genocide-y kind of guy back in the heady days of 600 BC. But anyway, according to the DOJ, the doctor profited from a global ransomware enterprise which sold tools, trained attackers in ransomware use, and conducted extortion, also trained people in extortion, and then was boasting about all the successful attacks they had done on this website, including attacks by attackers who were affiliated with the Iranian government. Okay. Now, Jigsaw has a decryptor from ImsaSoft, so if you have that one. And Thanos is pretty common. It appears to have died down some recently, but Thanos was pretty common, and it is a ransomware as a service. So this one, they said it was still regularly advertised on Russian hacker forums, but I can't read those, so my Russian's not there. Thanos is customizable, it's modular, it has a builder that you can also buy that lets you customize it even more. But Dr. Gonzalez was hosting a malware licensing server in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the United States, and there's where you slipped up. Thanos is also called Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods, Haron, and Hackbit. Those are all names of that are very similar ransomwares that apparently are also Thanos and were derivative of it. Anyway, it did not say if he'd been arrested. And, you know, France and Venezuela are kind of famous for no extradition. I mean, I don't even know how many times he said, I'm going to go to Venezuela to avoid this. And, you know, and I mean, just ask Roman Polanski. He can fill you in. And as long as you're on his crime kick, I wanted to mention this story because I saw it. Han Bing, who was a database admin for Liangjia, which is a Chinese real estate company. And I know I don't know how many Chinese viewers, listeners we have, but anyway, I put the story in mostly because of what happened and just as a warning. But basically, Liangjia is a big real estate company in China. And Han Bing got sentenced to 7 years in prison because he deleted the company's database in June of 2018. So what he did was he logged in and he used his root account to delete all the stored data from two database servers and two app services, which essentially shut down a large portion of Liangjia and caused tens of thousands of employees not to be paid. And it resulted in $30,000 in immediate damages just to restore the system. And they said it was unimaginable how much it actually cost the company in indirect costs, which, you know, they always say that anyway. But Liangjia has a market valuation of around $6 billion. So, yeah, it's not just a minor thing. But I only mentioned the story because of a couple of things. One, Mr. Bing had repeatedly advised the company about security flaws and sent numerous emails to the admins to raise concerns about security in their databases, and they basically ignored him. So this was like Steven Root in Office Space. You remember that movie? Yeah, he's the guy that's always sitting there and he's always going, burn the building down. Yeah, that kind of thing. So this is the guy that's over there going, oh, we have security problems. And they're going, yeah, whatever. But anyway, eventually he did get around to it. But anyway, he had a security update project that he proposed. It wasn't approved, and that made him a little bit upset. So my point is, insider threats are always a huge issue. So, you know, when you have employees who keep pointing things out, you may want to at least listen to what they have to say. especially if they're employees that have root access and they keep telling you, we really ought to fix this. And you keep going, sure, whatever. But on the other side of it, if you are the disgruntled employee who keeps telling people, look, just find another job. Just leave them alone and don't end up in jail for 7 years because your managers are stupid and you decide that you're going to prove it once and for all. Because we've all been there. You and I have all been there, and we've all been sitting there before going, I ought to just teach these guys a lesson. I'm just going to type RM minus F star sudo. We'll type sudo RM minus F star, and, you know, at the root and just say, there you go. I guess I'll show you that. But so don't do that. We all know that our iPhones are not quite Skynet, but they might be Skynet, but well, maybe not, but they could be. But this article talked about, even if you turn the iPhone off, and we all know you can't really turn your iPhone off, right? I mean, you think you can, and they kind of act like you can, but you know it's not really off because it comes on too quick. I mean, you can force it to reboot, but even if you put it in hard shutdown, apparently, according to these guys, it is still operating at a very low level. Some of the operations in the device are still running in a low power mode, which would allow, I guess, at least bare minimal Bluetooth communications or something so that you can use Find My iPhone, even if it's been turned off, which is probably a security measure that they put in place because if somebody steals your phone and they turn the phone off so you can't track them, you could actually sort of still track them. I'm not sure how much faith I have in that. But anyway, this article reported on ways to abuse all this, which would allow malware to run in the background even if the phone is powered off. The Bluetooth chip in the iPhone, which is used for this Find My feature, does not have a mechanism to be digitally signed or even to be encrypted. And the Technical University of Darmstadt, who they like to do this kind of stuff, we've seen stories from them before, but they found a way to exploit this, which would allow an attacker to track the phone or run other features even when the device is allegedly turned off. And there is a video in the article of them actually doing this. Now, apparently, it only works on jailbroken iPhones, which is not as common. You know, that's a tougher thing to do. Not that it can't be done, but and of course, if it's jailbroken already, then that leads to all kinds of other vectors. But this compromise, even though I don't think it's been observed in the wild, could be done for something like NSO Group's Pegasus software or whatever, which was being used to track journalists and dissidents over the last few years. And then even if you turn your phone off, so then, you know, basically all that's left is you throw your phone off, you know, off the Verrazano Narrows Bridge or something. But basically, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a huge issue like for most people, but it was a very interesting attack, and I thought you might like to check it out. Now, as long as we're on University of Research, the Radboud University and the University of Lausanne analyzed 100,000 top websites, and they didn't say how they determined that, but to see if a user visiting the site, and they looked at it from both the EU side and the US side, so they were sort of comparing the two because there's different rules in the US than the EU. They found that 1,844 of those sites, of the 100,000, so it's not a, I mean, it's pretty bad though, but 1,844 of those sites gathered the EU user's email address without their consent or without them even doing anything. They just, when they typed it in to a box, even if they never submitted it or did anything, it still captured it. 2,950 of the ones in the US did this because it's not actually illegal here since we don't have any decent privacy laws like they do in the EU. But some of the sites, 52 sites they found had third parties that were actually collecting data off the sites and collected password data before you hit the submit button. So they went and they type stuff in the password, you know, create a password box. And before you, even if you decided not to go through with it, they were already capturing your keystrokes out of those leaky boxes. And they basically said they contacted those 52 sites. And of course it was immediately resolved. Now this did include Yandex, which is the Russian browser engine, if you've been using that. But basically this is keystroke logging where you're typing. And even before you hit the submit button, everything's being grabbed up. So it's a pretty interesting report on how they can collect data on you for just visiting a site if you type something in, and they can then they're grabbing your email even if you decide maybe I don't really want to do this because now they're asking me for stuff, but I already typed my email address in or my email was automatically put in the box. They found 8,438 sites that were using metapixels, which if you aren't, we talked about that story before, that's a tiny little pixel that's almost invisible on the screen, and it actually probably is invisible to your eyes on the screen that leaks, that allows Meta, Facebook, to track information about you. 7,379 sites in the EU were doing this, which is a clear violation of EU law. They also found the TikTok pixel, which is essentially the same thing, and that was on 153 US sites and 147 EU sites. So the researchers then went on to create, wait for it, a Firefox extension called Leak Inspector. I'm like, Firefox? Really? But the Leak Inspector extension for Firefox will detect rogue form collection if you're using Firefox. So I guess at least a couple of hundred people will be able to prevent this. But they're going to get your day. Well, to be fair to Firefox, more people use that than use Edge. But they're going to get your data anyway. I mean, I'm not sure how short of living in a cabin in the North Woods you're going to prevent it. But, you know, marketing never sleeps, ever. They're always out there working to get that, you know, that little advantage. In that same light, sorry, U.S. citizens, but the EU, not the United States, is moving closer toward expanding their cybersecurity standards and reporting rules after the meeting of the European Council and Parliament called NIS2. This new directive, and there's a link to the directive in the article if you're in the EU and you don't want to read up on it, is going to replace the current directive on security of network and information system, which is NIS. And that was adopted in 2016. So NIS2 will have more stringent requirements and sanctions and may well include fines for a larger number of sectors who are not maintaining good, you know, policy. And that's going to require a lot of new people to comply with these. The original rule only applied to healthcare, digital infrastructure and service providers, transportation, water supply, banking and financial infrastructure and energy. The new list will expand to apply to all medium and large entities across a much broader spectrum, which included food, postal, courier, critical products. There's a whole list in the article if you are in the EU and you're wanting to read up on this. But they did continue to exclude the defense and national security agencies, public security, law enforcement, the judiciary, as well as parliaments and central banks. I'm like, okay, well, let's just exclude all this stuff. They may be covered by other laws. I'm not an attorney, and I'm certainly not an EU attorney. But the NIS2 will cover basic hygiene, training, the use of cryptography, human resource security, access control, assessment management, as well as incident response, crisis management, vulnerability handling, and disclosure, and all this kind of stuff. A lot like Sarbanes or some of these kind of things sounds like, only to a very, very large group of people. And it seems like a pretty sweeping change, so keep an eye on that. China announced that the Ministry of Public Security has determined that the five most prevalent types of fraud, which are done online or by telephone, are, number one was brushing. I have never heard that term before. I did not know what it meant. It was the first time I've ever heard the term brushing, but it was at the top of the list. But basically, this is a term that was used to describe where you're conned into paying for things that were not delivered. So certainly know that con. You know, hey, would you like to buy this really fancy exercise machine? I could get it to you for half what it costs retail, you know, like a Peloton or something. And yeah, they do that a lot. But also things as well as companies that send you things that you didn't order and then try to force you to pay for them. That's an old con as well. They just send you something in a box and then they start sending you bills and threats and all kinds of stuff if you don't give them some money. False investments and money management schemes were second on their list, then loan schemes. I don't really know. I don't know if loan schemes mean people offering fake loans or it's like, you know, people that are offering ridiculous rates or whatever, you know, where they do those tricks where they charge you interest by the day, you know. In the U.S., you can't do that. It's illegal. But a lot of places you can say, oh, it's only 2% interest, but that's 2% per hour, you know. Yeah, that kind of stuff. That's called loan sharking. Yeah. Impersonation of customer service operatives was next, and then falsely claiming to represent legal authorities. Yeah, so whatever the Chinese equivalent of the IRS is. Hi, you owe your taxes. They did announce then a month-long anti-fraud campaign. Yeah. Well, since Jason is filling in for me on two consecutive Fridays, one while I went to my daughter's graduation and the other while I'm doing move-out stuff, I won't give him a silly introduction today. I'm just going to say Jason is a great pen tester and an incident responder. Really? So please welcome Jason.
Wow, I just don't know what to say over this, Doug. This is... harkens back a couple of years now where we just had a straight up introduction. Oh, well,
I slay myself.
Good to have you back with us. And I told everybody that you missed them on Friday, so you'd be looking forward to seeing them again. So my story, I was actually kind of zeroed in on an announcement that just came out from Google today, from at their cloud security summit that they are currently running. And it was why it got my attention is it just kind of goes at one of the larger challenges that we have in, you know, the use of and the of open source software, the development of it. And this is really just about, you know, the security that goes into these applications or these projects. Because you get this, you know, somebody decides, hey, we've got an issue over here. We've talked about different vulnerabilities, of course, on the show that have popped up in different open source projects. Somebody's working away trying to make this thing work. And do what it is they intend to do. They may or may not have much in the way of resources, even on some of the larger projects, to do security testing and ongoing fuzzing and things like that. And that's essentially what Google has announced here. They have come out with a new service that they will be releasing publicly that allows companies or customers to submit packages to that to for fuzzing and some other stuff that Google is offering along with this. So, you know, this is kind of, I looked at it and thought, okay, this is kind of cool because, you know, this is a problem we've been dealing with for a long time. Everybody, I'm sure, who's listening has had to deal with vulnerabilities that have cropped up in open source applications that they use. Sometimes that used to make me cry a long time ago when, you know, oh crud, there's a new vulnerability in Apache, for example. I've got to recompile everything and redeploy this out across a number of hosts. And this is going to take a while and be a lot of work. But really, the seriousness of the issue around some of these projects and the security flaws that can crop up, and honestly, the amount of resources really is what I'm thinking about that are available to these projects really kind of hit home to me when Heartbleed came out back in 2014. You know, here you've got this vulnerability, you know, serious vulnerability at OpenSSL. Everybody is, I mean, pretty much everybody is using it and depending on this. And we've got memory, you know, leak of sensitive data occurring, you know, where somebody can query the memory through this vulnerability. And then it comes out that, hey, this is actually a really small development team that's actually taking care of OpenSSL, and they've got like no resources available to them. They're doing this out in their own time for the most part. And holy cow, they, you know, they're just kind of stuck. And they responded to that and got that going and got things fixed. But, you know, you could see how this kind of cascaded out of control because here's these folks working on their own time and their own dime. And then everybody is using it and isn't getting any help back. There have been others. Log4j obviously is the most recent open source application or biggest impact of vulnerability we've had in a while around this. And everybody dove on that and everybody's trying to get that patched. So, you know, Google is basically recognizing this as an issue. They've recognized it for a while, obviously, with some of the things that they have released publicly in the past about different vulnerabilities. But this new service is going to be called the Assured Open Source Software. And, you know, Google in their blog post, that I was actually able to find. I'll add that to the show notes after the show because I found it just before coming on the air. Talks about, hey, you know, we give some information in here about it. And they state, you know, hey, we're already fuzzing somewhere around 550 applications that are some of the most widely used open source projects around. Probably applications that they use really heavily inside of Google, and that's why they're really concerned about this. And, you know, this, what they're focusing on even now with this is the idea of we're going to focus on Java and Python because those are most important to Google in their development processes. So they're still kind of taking care of themselves here. But they're going to essentially continue to expand on this. People who sign up or, you know, can submit packages that they use in their own development to do this testing. And some of this sounded honestly like how AWS got started. You know, somebody at Amazon, you know, they're building out this massive website, and somebody looks at it and says, hey, you know, we have all this infrastructure that we use. I bet you we could maybe sell this to the public. And so they write a white paper about it. It gets passed around, and we have a release of a little known software application called S3. And it becomes a wild hit. And now we have the behemoth that we have today of AWS with all of the different services associated with that available to us via subscription, and on and on. And that's kind of what it sounds like is going on here. Google's been doing this for a while, and they've turned around and said, hey, let's package this up. Maybe somebody will want to buy this and probably put a lot of work into finding out that yes, they do. Now, Google has already found a number of vulnerabilities in open source software. One of the numbers they trotted out as of January of 2022, to the tune of 36,000 vulnerabilities discovered and reported back out. Now we're going to have this paid service. That the way it works, as I was looking at it, you not only have the package you're interested in, but this is something that they're going to basically maintain, compile with configuration around that, and so you say, okay, here's what it is, here's how I want it, I want to use this. You tie into this process, and they go through their process of compiling it, testing it, and managing it for you, so that essentially you get the benefit of all of that work without having to roll that into your own organization. Kind of fits nicely in with that idea of software as a service. This is kind of like secure development as a service. I don't know how they will phrase this, but there's, I guess, assured open source software. Anyhow, they'll take care of all of this. I thought this was it's an interesting look at it. At first I thought, oh, well, like they're doing this publicly for free. No, that's not the case. But they are releasing things out to the public. I mean, they've got their OSS fuzz, which they talk about in the register article that I have linked in the show notes. That's out on GitHub. It's a Python application that you can use to fuzz your own applications. I checked just before the show, the latest commit to the project was like 8 minutes ago. So they're obviously very active on this, and that's something you can just pull down and use ourselves. The part that I'm really curious about with this, and I assume that it's going to fit into how they've done this before, is, okay, we've got this service, we're charging people for this. How are they going to feed this back out into the open source software projects themselves? Or are they going to just kind of keep this internal? I don't think that would be the case. I would assume that they would, oh, we found a new vulnerability, let's go notify Nginx that this is here, or whatever the software is behind this, or some library. And we'll notify them so that they can update their code. And then you'll have the way that they have coordinated disclosure already. They talk to the project, and then once things are taken care of at some point, they decide to go public with that. I assume that that would be the case. I hope that that's the case, because then that basically extends more of that reach out to some of these projects as this grows over time. Because some now the customers who are paying for the service are footing the bill for a lot of this testing. And so more packages start getting tested, and more of this stuff starts getting fed back out to the open source ecosystem. At least that is my thoughts on it, and how I hope that it's going to play out. We'll see actually how this works. I'm kind of interested to see reviews on when this gets finally released, how effective it is, what, customers' experiences are, and see how that dynamic here between the open source world and this service come into play. So if you're interested in this, I'll put the post for the link for the Google post in the show notes after the show, and you can take a look here. They've got more details about how they're doing the compilation and managing some of their discoveries and artifacts that they have in the process. So go ahead and take a look if this is something that of interest to you. Something I'm going to be keeping an eye on myself.
All right, thank you, Jason. I've already wanted to go check that out. I was like, that sounds very interesting, especially if they got open source version that I can play with. All right, and finally, well, Elon promised to buy Twitter for an astronomical amount of money, $44 billion, but now seems to be trying to renegotiate this since, well, it's a lot of money for Twitter. And of course, all the tech stocks have been in like a downward spiral for the last few days and so forth. So Elon may be sort of rethinking this, you know, gee, I don't care, $44 billion, whatever. It's like me buying a Subway token or something. But anyway, Elon said a lot of things. But the latest one that he just said today, apparently, is that the deal cannot move forward unless Twitter can prove that bots are less than 5% of total users. And he went on to say that Parag Agrawal, who's the CEO of Twitter, refused publicly to demonstrate proof of their claim that bots are less than 5% of the total users of Twitter, and then proceeded to tweet a poop emoji. Yeah, that's what we've come to. He proceeded to tweet a poop emoji at their explanation about the automated accounts. Musk went on and claimed that on Teslarati, which is like his Twitter feed, said that 20% or more of the users were bots on Twitter and that that was too high. He claimed that his offer was based on their SEC filing and that their SEC filing was not accurate, and challenged them to prove their claims in public, and went on to say that the deal could not move forward until proof was provided. Now, Musk's commitment to this whole deal, despite all the chatter, you know, about the $44 billion, he was only going to pay $1 billion, which is essentially the equivalent of me buying a single cigarette on the street in Manhattan, because he's worth like, you know, some, I mean, crazy amount of money. I mean, I don't know why, but he put together a consortium or borrowed the money. I don't know where the money was coming from. But anyway, the other $43 billion, I guess, was being provided by someone else. Well, we'll see what happens. I was shocked that only 20% of Twitter was bots, personally. I always thought it was mostly bot. And that's the news. Thanks, Jason. I will be out this Friday. And once again, the estimable Jason Wood will be filling in. See you then.